Noah, thank you so much for coming back after just a short time. Noah is a journalist and a contributor to The Washington Post, The Guardian, and a few other outlets. And we spoke just recently about issues regarding fake news and journalism and even how tech startup CEOs really are dictating freedom of speech online these days. And since our last conversation, a lot of things relevant to that, incidents relevant to that, have occurred again. We'll link to that conversation in the description below so you can find that prior conversation for some context. But Noah, one of the first things that happened just a little bit after we spoke that really made me think of you was Airbnb's actions for banning Jewish listings in the West Bank. Can you tell me a little bit about that and sort of your take on that, both coming from a Jewish background as well as just having previously talked to me about sort of the censorship that could happen through big tech platforms?
For sure. First of all, thank you for having me back on.
Of course.
Without the dog, although I brought his, you could say his fur, literally. it's a great question. I think it took a lot of people by surprise because it was such a bold move on Airbnb's part. The timing, a lot of people are saying that it was because of there was a Human Rights Watch report that was going to come out criticizing different companies, Airbnb, Bookings.com, mm-hmm. some other ones for doing these listings in West Bank, Judea, Samaria, depending on the language that you use. And it was, before we've seen sort of like Twitter ban certain people for speech that they don't like mm-hmm. and political speech that they don't like as well. And then we've seen Facebook sort of take similar actions. There have been some exposés about what their sort of guidelines are. The New York Times published a lengthy piece on that, and it seemed somewhat arbitrary and somewhat.
But they published a piece on what these various big tech companies' guidelines are for taking things down?
Yeah, so okay. Facebook specifically is the one I'm familiar with, and so it was from somewhere else. I think somewhere else another outlet had published something, and then Facebook followed up with sort of like the actual like elucidation of what it was, like the actual PowerPoint. Somehow they got they got access to those, and it would seem they were suggesting that it was sort of like piecemeal and weird things. So sort of like you could insult a whole group. Oh no, you couldn't insult a whole group. You could insult specific individuals or subsets of that group. So you could say something against, for instance, black children, I think is the example that they used, and that was okay. Speech against them was okay because it was a subset of black people.
According to Facebook's policy.
This is Facebook's guidelines. But then if you wanted to insult like all black people, you couldn't do that. But black, and then like a subset of it, specificity was the issue with that.
Did they offer any guidelines about what specific means? Like, children just seems very broad to me,
No, I don't know. I don't remember that they did. I think it was just literally a subset of a group. But getting to your question, so we've seen that before, and we've seen that increasingly going on, like we talked about before. Mm-hmm. This, though, is a departure, I think, in a lot of people's minds, including my own. I mean, I can speak as a Jew. I can speak as a journalist. I can speak as just and also just, like, an observer, right? But, like, the issue is that this is a highly contentious debate. This is a highly contentious, so to wade into the middle of that, when even, it's something that politicians don't even want to talk about because they're not so certain about it, and you've seen Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez get into problems because she was commenting on that conflict, and then she kind of took a step back in the middle of this one interview on, I think it was called Firing Line, and she's like, yeah, I'm not the geopolitical expert or something. I don't know, leave me alone. So for Airbnb as a public, or not yet, it's going to, they're going, moving towards an IPO, certainly a huge private company, and their whole, motto is like, everyone is welcome, and they sort of are using this like woke as a business model, Pepsi did with Kendall Jenner, and like we're seeing now with Gillette, with the ad against like toxic masculinity, and so then Airbnb is sort of like, not one-upped, but like five-upped everybody, and we're like, all right, we're going to do something that's going to like push action forward, and push something for it. I really don't know why they feel like they want to get in the middle of what is a dispute between, first of all, two different, nationalistic groups, but then probably the most contentious geopolitical issue. But they did. And the impact of it is that it was essentially a situation where they're saying, if you are Jewish and if you live in what is historically known as Judea and Samaria for thousands of years, but now is called the West Bank, you cannot list your house. If you are anything but Jewish in that area, you can. So you could have a Jewish person and a non-Jewish person, Muslim, Buddhist, Christian, atheist, whatever it is, and then they can list their housing. And so,
can you give me a little bit more of the context? I mean, this is, to me, that is very striking. I'm very surprised that they did that as well. Like, I was taken aback, but I didn't realize that there was potentially this context of being reviewed by a human rights organization. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so...
And just why that matters.
Yeah, you know? So Human Rights Watch is, an international NGO that looks at human rights violations around the world. Mm-hmm. Sort of the veracity of their reports and sort of where they fall on the line in general, I mean, that's sort of a separate conversation that... frankly, I'm not as equipped to have. I mean, I've not necessarily followed all the work all around the world. I mean, the stuff in China seems legit, the stuff in Russia. I do know, in the Israeli-Palestinian context, that the person who was leading that organization was a pro-Palestinian activist for a decade or more. I mean, you can go and see his videos on YouTube, on Facebook. People have posted them of him railing against the Jewish state, of him pushing boycott measures, and then they install him as, like, the nonpartisan human rights observer in the area. And so, number one, obviously, anything that comes out from that starting point is going to be suspect. But more than that, taking it a separate direction, the issue is that they wanted to get out in front of this thing. And that's, again, I don't know that. They haven't told me that. I was in touch with Airbnb's press representatives, the lead of whom, from the global standpoint, is directly from the Obama administration. And when I asked him about this, he forwarded two news articles from two different outlets that are sort of not, I can't, mainstream, I suppose, but certainly written from, being supportive of what they're doing and saying, look, if the American government won't act, at least Airbnb will. Airbnb, will take these measures. And so they seem to have, taken themselves on as this, governmental sort of agency, in a sense, taking this kind of an action against Jews.
Okay. And so why... Is it just like a type of virtue signaling? Like I'm not really understanding why these big companies really care about what a human, and why would a Human Rights Watch agency be looking into wading through tech policies anyway? What was the...
Oh, so no, so there wasn't a direct connection between those two.
Oh,
or actually, no, wait, there was. There's a lot of things to juggle here. So it was that they were going to come up with this report, basically another sort of criticism of Israeli policies in this region, and then calling out these different tech companies for basically offering listings, which they were saying was contributing to the problem. It was saying that, look, the people who are living there, who are Jewish, they're saying it's a problem for them to live there, right? The Germans, it's always what's the thing about, you have a discussion long enough on the internet and you start talking about Nazis, but in a very serious, way, it's saying, it's a religious thing. It's saying that if you're Jewish, you shouldn't be living in this area, right? I mean, that's what they said in Gaza, and then they made Gaza Judenrein, which is the Nazi term, to take all the Jews out of Gaza, and then that wasn't enough. And so now it's a similar situation there, except the difference is that Jews don't have a historical connection to what's now Gaza, but Judea is why we're called Jews.
Yeah.
I mean, so any sort of historical argument sort of starts and ends there. If we want to talk about modern policy, though, and that's, by the way, it's not a biblical argument. I mean, that's a historical, you can dig in the ground and find support for these sort of, to find Jews there. But as far as what's going on now, so it's, you have people who are Palestinian who are living there now, you have people who are Jewish, Israelis who are living there now, and so what this Human Rights Watch was saying is that you are basically, you Airbnb, you Bookings.com are contributing to this problem. And so Airbnb didn't want to be in the position of basically providing income and resources and allowing the people who live there, who are Jewish, to benefit from living
there
and from being there. And so if you're asking me why Human Rights Watch felt that they wanted to wade into tech policy, I don't know that that's what they wanted to do. I think that they have their agenda, and then they're just saying, look, you're in violation, and then they called them out, and Airbnb, and this is speculation, but they clearly succumbed to that and said, yeah, you're right. And they obviously made a business decision that doing that was going to be more beneficial for their business in the long run. I don't know why. I mean, perhaps they have more clients that are against mm-hmm. Israel and for Israel, perhaps something to do with the IPO and what they felt the valuation would be. I can tell you that there's been a good amount of backlash. There was a new lawsuit filed in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. There was a lawsuit I know filed in Florida. The governor of Florida, newly elected, basically, I think there was something that came out a few days ago, I'm trying to remember, that like prohibited Florida state businesses from investing in, like public businesses from investing in Airbnb. Mm-hmm. And from a private standpoint, I don't know how that works because it is a private company. So, I'm not sure if they expected this kind of backlash or if they didn't, but they're getting it.
And so shifting away from tech startups a little bit, I mean, you brought up the Gillette ad. That was pretty similar, really, I mean, in terms of what's going on there. But why, are businesses that take these approaches to making a big political statement, are they well-received? I mean, it sounds like Airbnb was kind of a mixed bag, but like the Gillette ad, I didn't follow what happened to their stock or anything after the fact. I know that there's some pretty heated debates on social media, but what really happens? Does it help them? Does it not? Are they trying to shift to a political maneuver? Is it just sort of this marketing, any business, any publicity is good publicity move?
I think it's that. I mean, we can't lose sight of the fact that these are corporations whose job is to make money for their shareholders and mm-hmm. to stay profitable and to gain customers. And in their minds, we saw it with Nike, with Colin Kaepernick a few months ago. We saw it, obviously, with these examples that you're talking about. I don't think there's a debate about it. I mean, it's clearly just to drive some sort of attention cycle and to keep themselves in the news. We're talking about it right now. Mm-hmm. You know, and yeah, a lot of people were heated about it. A lot of people say, oh, I'm not going to buy Gillette razors anymore. I'm not going to this and that. But who cared about Gillette? Gillette's been an irrelevant company. I mean, I don't want to be too harsh. I don't have like a thing against Gillette. But like for me, when we talk about razors, for the few minutes I've spent thinking about this, I mean, it's Dollar Shave Club, right? And that's been the whole thing. And their acquisition for like $1 billion or something based on pure marketing. That's the only thing about Dollar Shave Club is like they made those great viral ads with the CEO who's going around the.
I don't know what the Dollar Shave Club is.
So you pay a dollar and then they send you a razor.
Oh,
every month or however much it is, they have different packages and sets and this and that. Okay. And so they were saying their whole thing was like, yeah, this is really great. I mean, iconic ad. The founder of that company, and he's like, look, you don't really need 3 or 4 or 5 blades, whatever it is, you know, and technology and vibers. You just need, you know. Good enough, basically. We'll send it to you for a dollar, whatever it is, and that's it. Now you don't have to spend, because those cartridges, those Gillette cartridges, those are expensive as hell.
Yeah.
Like $15, $20 for like, it adds up. It adds up. So someone in that marketing department at Gillette clearly made a business decision of like, look, whatever poll number, whatever it is, whatever information they have, like, all right, this is going to be well received by enough people mm-hmm. that it's not going to kill us, right? It's not going to be like we're promoting... Mm-hmm. Nazis or something, right? And then the rest of the people who don't like it, well, but they're going to talk about us and they're going to keep us in the cycle. And, you know, there's a lot of different studies, and I mean, you know way more about this than me, about how references work in terms of, you know, people's decisions and...
Yeah, just familiarity.
So familiarity and everything. So, again, I'm not on the inside of Gillette either, but it seems very clear that I don't know many companies that would take, like, this principled business decision, especially of that size, when if they thought there was actually going to be backlash or like a highly negative consequence to their bottom line.
Yeah. So shifting gears a bit, the second thing that, like big thing that made me think of you after our conversation was the Covington Catholic debacle. So yeah. Back then we had talked about like fake news and what people really mean when they talk about fake news, and how at the time I really wasn't sure what people were referencing. And now, I mean, it's still pretty recent, but Covington Catholic, I think, has become sort of this iconic fake news thing that people point to. Can you tell me a little bit about your perspective of what happened as a journalist and sort of the morale among your colleagues as well
sure.
as that was unfolding?
Sure. So... that's been the best and scariest example, I think, of any of this so far. There's like the Hillary Clinton thing with the pizza where someone was like started shooting.
Pizzagate.
Like that was pizza. Like, that was actually the scariest because of the gun violence and everything like that. But in terms of actual just like weirdness and actual just like a visceral example of what all of this is, because I'll tell you the truth. When I saw the first video, the first one that was released, I think it was Saturday night is when that came out. I saw that and I was like, wow, that's messed up. that's crazy, and I can't believe these kids are doing this, and this is awful, and this Native American man, and all this, and all that narrative, you know, I saw it, and that was what I thought, and I didn't write anything about it. I try not to write too much on social media in general, or try to write too much about those sort of incidents, those sort of situations, so quickly after it happens, because oftentimes, it's dead wrong, a lot of that information, a lot of that reporting, and so, you know, fast forward to the next day when, like, the full cut came out, like, I didn't watch the whole 2 hours, but I certainly, you know, you scrub through it, and you see, all right, the Black Hebrew group is saying all this stuff, and then, you know, you cut to the part where it's actually the confrontation, and it's anything at that point but clear what's going on. And then people are saying, well, they said this, well, they said that, well, if you hear about this and you hear about that. And so then it sort of just, like, devolves into this, you know, what are you inclined to believe sort of thing, and then you'll find it in that video, like a Rorschach test. Where it says more about the person commenting a lot of times than the actual video, although I will say that some of the things that came out, it was clear that people were just dead-ass wrong. And people wanted to advance their sort of narrative, whether left or right, and then use that video to do it, especially in the beginning it was more on the left and social justice and outrage culture and everything like that. And then it sort of swung back around. There was a Rabbi Sov piece in Reason that sort of like reassessed the whole thing, and then it kind of swung back again after people were like, well, but wait a minute, they still did this, this, and this. And then it just turned into this like, just kind of like, he's sort of like, you know, I hired a PR firm, and then he gave that interview, the kid, and it was, he like wasn't blinking, and he cleared the coach, don't blink when you do your interview, and talk in measured tones, and just say the same thing over and over again. I had a right to be there, and did it, and don't apologize. And he was just coached with that. And then, oh, this guy, then Nathan Phillips, the Native American guy, oh, he went to Vietnam, he didn't go to Vietnam, he was in the Marines, he was in the Marines, he didn't go to Vietnam, this, that, and then people lost interest by now. So.
Yeah. Well, so what happened on the other side of the print? Like, what happened with journalists during that unfolding?
There was a reckoning. There was definitely a reckoning from a lot of people who, it was, it just caused them to reassess how they're getting news and how they're making their sort of like opinions and how they're shifting their angles and everything like that. And the New York Times had to post, not a retraction, but like a follow-up to it even. So, you know, they did all this reporting about this, this, and this happened, and then, oh, but wait a minute, the rest of the story shows, you know, the rest of it. And so there was a lot of people who basically were, I was reading, I mean, this is just more on Twitter, and also personal conversations, if I think about it, that were like, well, we need to take a minute and see. We need to wait for these things to play out more. The challenge in that is obviously speed. How quickly does news get out there? And do you want to be the first one all the time, obviously, to have that on the one hand? On the other hand, a lot of these people who are, you know, would refer themselves as journalists, but are more just like hot take artists, you know, and just have like controversial opinions or very strong partisan opinions, and they want to get their, you know, their stuff out there, because you don't get many followers when you're just sort of like trying to play it down the middle. And just be like, well, let's, you know, tweet, this is interesting, let's see what happens. You know what I mean? And, it's like, it rewards Twitter and this sort of like social media, it rewards like arguments and partisanship, it rewards hot takes, it rewards like sick burns and insults and things like that, and not really like reasoned sort of like discussion and analysis, and, you know, it's probably not this and this, it's probably...
So a similar thing that I just recently learned very little about is Gamergate. I saw this interview of Candace Owens, which is a very controversial perspective on that whole thing. I should say biased perspective. And so how, can you tell me a little bit about Gamergate? Because I still don't know a ton. And also like similarities to what's going on with Covington Catholic and fake news and how that's all kind of related.
Sure. So it's funny. It's like the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, Gamergate, and then like quantum mechanics, and try to reconcile quantum mechanics with like relativity theory. And then I think we'll be set. I mean, these are really, Gamergate's weird. Gamergate's weirder than any of the other ones, because it was a precursor to this whole like fake news, you know, debate that we're having now about just divergent realities with people. Because you talk to some people on the side of, and let me back up a step. Gamergate is basically a campaign, right? Or an incident, a situation that unfolded on social media mostly, where you had a female woman who had designed a game. But it was like a different kind of game. It was like I don't remember exactly. It was like a choose your adventure sort. It wasn't like what you typically think of a game with like characters and playing and levels and stuff.
Is that Zoe Quinn? Is that where she comes in? Okay.
So, I believe so. And so then basically that, so that game got reviewed because she was dating, I think his name's Nathan Fletcher or something, and then they had broken up, and then she went after him or something. You know, it was like some one of these things, you know, it was like people were going at each other, you know, with personal reasons, stuff like that. And so then you had a whole lot of people online, gamers that were like, basically, you know, this is about ethics in gaming journalism. Like, she's getting these reviews because, you know, basically, like, she's a woman and this and that. And then some people were like, no, it's because of she's good and it's worth it. And we're trying, there's marginalized people in the community and everything like that. And then on the other hand, the people who felt like that and felt like they were sort of like there something wasn't fair and that journalism was sort of falling short, basically lashed out and attacked. Just it started with her, but then it just it sort of like spiraled into just women in gaming, basically, and really like vicious attacks. Like forget about just like mean words and stuff, but like threats, death threats, doxing people, swatting people.
To her, to Zoe Quinn,
so her and
or
to women,
all other women.
Yeah, in general. And to the point where like legislation was being discussed about like, you know, how to prevent these things from happening. It was actually a pretty serious incident. It wasn't just like a bunch of kids joking online saying like mean things. So yeah, I mean, and that sort of that level of rhetoric and debate and then anger and hatred and implied violence. And I mean, luckily, I don't think there was any actual violence that took place out of it. But when someone's like tweeting at you, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to find you, and then tweeting your address and your family's and this net, that's that, you know, it's not physical violence, but it's
certainly
not great.
Something is violated.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want that to happen. So, yeah, Gamergate was sort of a forerunner to a lot of the debates that we're having right now.
Okay. And so how is that, can you draw the dots for me between Gamergate and you said that was sort of the forerunner before the whole hot issue of fake news?
Yeah. Well, in the sense of like people are seeing what they want to see and then can have those voices be amplified and accelerated by social media. So, you know, instead of like the fake news debate, like what happened in Gamergate, there was no like, I guess you actually could say, because they're saying that like a lot of these reviews and a lot of this journalism was, I mean, fake news means so many different things to different people, but like basically it wasn't legit and they felt that it was pushing an agenda and they felt that it was not actually reporting news, it was advocating for a cause. And it sort of, that sort of
Gamergate was advocating for a cause.
Like, not Gamergate itself, the journalists that
reported,
I'm not
going to
say caused it, but like, that were involved in that, were reporting in that fashion. And we're trying to sort of advance these, again, like inclusivity and diversity and, you know, these sort of like buzzwords that take place, which I don't know. Like, I don't know many people, like, it's a weird thing because, like, who's against, like, diversity? Diversity is a good thing. Who's against, like, having different people involved in these communities and being have access to these jobs and stuff like that? But then it the way that it gets weaponized by people, I think that's where a lot of the times the frustration and the anger comes from. For a lot of people, for some people, are just hate, you know, just hateful, and they probably are against those things. They don't want people who don't look like them or think like them or believe like them to be a part of their communities online, which is, I have nothing to say to them. You know, those are irreconcilables. But I'm saying for most people, it's probably something in the middle, and there was a lot of people who had, as they do now with fake news, where they're reading whatever it is, I don't, New York Times article, or a better example would be like a Huffington Post article, you know, and they see certain buzzwords and they see certain things being sort of like taken sine qua non and they don't agree with it, and then it's like, wait, but we're having to speak like this now, and this is like the Jordan Peterson like compelled speech because it's in the New York Times or it's in Huffington Post. And so a lot of those same debates, a lot of those same problems, a lot of those same issues can be seen in Gamergate as they can be seen now in what people talk about, you know, fake news. And I mean, as far as the like people writing articles about well, I won't say it that way, but like people, you know, advancing causes through journalism or what's supposed to be like objective journalism. I mean, I think we're at a point where we should just come clean with a lot of it. And that's just me personally, like they do in England. Like when you read a Guardian article in England, the British people know that's a leftist newspaper. And they know that, you know, and we hear it's like the New York Times masquerades like it's an objective middle of the line newspaper. See, you're laughing. I mean, and everybody laughs. Like, and if you visit that newsroom, you will find a very much, you have diversity in terms of backgrounds, but even people on the left would say that there's not a lot of diversity in terms of When I say backgrounds, I mean ethnic and racial backgrounds, but not in terms necessarily of like experiences. Mm-hmm. A lot of them went to, you know, Ivy League schools, you know, sort of are in mm-hmm. the same New York circles and, you know, coastal circles. And yeah. it shows in the reporting the same way you can see it on the right with different outlets on the right. And that's, I mean, it's discussed more, I feel like. Yeah. So, I mean, we can talk about that too. But
well, I'm sort of wondering where this is all going. I know that I sort of have two trains of thought in my mind. One is, where is this going? Is there any like trend for how you think fake news is going to be addressed in journalistic communities? So that's one train of thought. Another train of thought is, I've been hearing a lot about all kinds of layoffs of journalists, and I'm wondering what's going on there, why that's happening, what the causes are, and whether or not it is related to a lot of poor reporting or extremely slanted reporting. It seems like in my interactions on social media, people are kind of suggesting, oh, well, it's journalists' fault that all this big layoff stuff is happening because it's due to irresponsible reporting practices. I don't know that that's fair. I don't know what's going on. So I'm curious about your take on all that, and I know there's a lot in there.
All right, that's fair enough. I'll answer the second question first, then okay. come back to the first one. No, I don't think that it's the fault of journalists at all, whatsoever, that okay. this happened. And BuzzFeed, like, you know, they catch a lot of flack for because of, like, the cat videos and the quizzes and stuff like that, but mm-hmm. they do good report. You know, BuzzFeed News was doing great reporting. They were getting mm-hmm. scoops. They were, you know, doing some interesting, like, investigative work. And they had good journalists, too, mm-hmm. From different outlets that ended up there. And so this is to me, just blaming the victims. The reason why they got fired, I mean, we're not business people. You know, we're not the ones cutting the deals with the advertisers. We're not the one getting sponsors. We're in fact segregated from that. We're separate mm-hmm. from that. There's supposed to be a line that's drawn between those things, and whether or not that's the case, that's a separate discussion. But to put it at the feet of the journalists is absurd. And there's a certain amount of, like, you know, Schadenfreude, what is it?
Schadenfreude, yeah.
Yeah, of that. And I
yeah,
get that.
I think you're right.
And that's fine. You know, and you know, if you're that the kind of person who takes joy in other people's misfortunes, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. But no, that's absurd. And in fact, I would say it would be the opposite. Like, if they were doing that, if they were creating those contentious pieces that, you know, that they're being accused of creating, mm-hmm. then actually that would be drawing more, not less, traffic, which was the whole thing about fake news. In fact, these Macedonians and Russians, I believe, I know the Macedonians, I just saw an interesting documentary about it called Selling Lies. I don't know if it has distribution yet, but it's excellent. It gets into it. And the whole reason basically most of them were doing it was because they figured out that the more controversial and the more sort of like contentious these articles were, the more people click on it. They figured out trying thing with Trump gets clicked on. Anything that's like disparaging to Hillary, you know, a lot of times also gets clicked on it. And so if it was the case that that's what they were doing, then theoretically, according to that like reasoning and what we know about fake news and the way that it sort of like disseminates itself, that mm-hmm. would be the opposite case. No, it's poor business decisions by Jonah Peretti, you know, the head of BuzzFeed, or it's poor business decisions by, you know, I think, who else was in this round? Like Verizon, I think, right? Verizon Media Group, Oath, right? That's like the AOL, like, zombie that...
Has anything changed in their business-making decisions, or is this just sort of a thing that's been a long time in the coming?
Listen, I think it's a long time coming, and I think that, it's you know, it's their business decisions. I mean, you got to be fair to them also, I suppose. Like, it's an unprecedented time mm-hmm. that we're in right now in media, but then in particular in, like, digital online news media. It's all unprecedented. There was an interesting, like, tweet storm I saw from someone who sort of, he had his theory about how this worked, and to do with, like, advertisers and interest being aligned, like, the advertisers and the publishers as they're trying to reach their audience. And in the past, they were aligned mm-hmm. because there wasn't as much possible segmentation about who's just the reader versus who's a potential customer, and now you can segment amongst those two groups, and so now advertisers want to be more direct, and they don't just want to just sort of like have a buckshot blast of just like advertising, they want to direct it, and so there's no, and this is, you know, it's trying to like, it ends up becoming, because of the way things have evolved with Facebook and Google, trying to fortune tell what Facebook's algorithm or Google's algorithm is going to do, and how it's going to benefit or disparage your company. And I mean, I can't sit here and say I would know any better necessarily than any of the other people who made these bets. But I will say that it was bizarre to me, because if they do want to stay as news media companies, if that's what BuzzFeed in fact wants to do, I don't know why you'd fire all your people who create that product, which is what they did. But, I mean, the reports I'm reading are that they want to merge themselves, or they want to try something else, or they want to, you know, there's a lot of stuff with TV now. So you see BuzzFeed running around LA trying to sell TV shows and trying to get, like, Slate deals, which are, like, you like, basically get a network to just buy all your stuff, and it's lucrative. But usually it goes to, like, people like Ryan Murphy, who's a producer, and Shonda Rhimes, you know, people in more of the traditional TV field, not BuzzFeed.
Yeah.
The second question, which was the first question, was where is it all going?
Yeah, where is this going? And
I think it's not going to a good place. I can say that.
Okay.
Unfortunately, from a news standpoint and a business standpoint too, because I don't know that any lessons. I'll start with the business side. I don't know that any lessons have been learned necessarily by any of these outlets. I mean, and it's not just. I mean, Huffington Post. BuzzFeed's like at the forefront of this, right? Mm-hmm. But Vice is going through a lot of the same issues because they were at one point valued at like $4 or $5 billion, right? Wow. But now we're seeing a bunch of like what's the equivalent of like a margin call on that valuation. And people are saying, well, wait a minute, your whole thing was like you're inserting yourselves as the, you know, people aren't watching TV anymore. People, you know, kids aren't watching TV anymore. Kids aren't doing the things they used to do. But if you give us your advertising money, we're talking to the kids and we're really cool and they'll watch our stuff. And you know, that worked for a really long time and to $4 to $5 billion. But at a certain point, which was the last earnings call or 2 months ago or whatever it was, when it sort of people were like, wait a minute, your cable channel gets less viewers than, I forgot exactly what it was, but like then the channel they bought, which was like H2, like History Channel 2 or something. And so, and those are like the people that are supposed to know everything, like Vice. They're supposed to know exactly how to do this and manage this. Okay. And BuzzFeed is supposed to be like, again, another leader in these things. And we're finding that they don't know. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, the fake news mongers, as such as they are getting better. They're not getting worse, they're getting better. And Facebook certainly is not reacting in any sort of way that I can discern that seems to be addressing any of this. I know that now if you want to post certain things online and it's political, then you have to, I mean, I had someone tell me that you have to give them your social security number or something. And it's like,
to Facebook.
I think so, which is like, okay, because you guys don't know everything about me quite yet, so let me just give you the rest of it so that Cambridge Analytica 2 can scoop that up as well. So, excuse me.
This is for individuals, or is this like, if you're like one of those persons with an approved page because you've reached a certain threshold of popularity?
I think that's what it was. One thing is an individual, right? You can write whatever you certainly cannot write whatever you want on Facebook, but as far as like news articles and I think it was political activity, I'd have to check the exact language on it. But so there's, again, there are no measures there that lead me to believe, at least, that they have addressed anything in, you know, as far as it's coming up for like the next election cycle. Mm-hmm. Certainly, I mean, the one positive thing would be that people are at least more aware of this. You know, 2006, I don't think the general population was aware of this situation. And what it was and how it sort of happened. And so I think people are a little bit more attuned to being more critical of news sources than they were. But at the same time, you're seeing all kinds of new technology that's being used to spoof, they call it deep fakes. So like to spoof people talking, you know, and people saying things they never actually said, but now you can manipulate their face to say things that they may have never said. And so that's going to be tough to combat. And I think, though, the biggest problem is just increasing divisions in society that seem to exist. And I always take a critical view of it because just in my day-to-day interactions, it seems to be different than what I see online and what everyone else seems to be telling me about. We're divided, more divided than ever, and angry, and this and that. And there's certainly evidence for it, but I don't know. I mean,
so it sounds like you're thinking that it's really going to have to come from just consumers of news being able to discern better.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, in this documentary where they had the people that were doing this fake news, that's what they said basically. They said, yeah, I mean, because they were saying that basically they were taking news reports from right skewing news outlets and rewriting them. That's what they said. They were making things up on the basis, you know, using like a nugget of truth and then a bunch of bullshit.
Yeah.
But what they said is that, look, yes, we did this, but I think they said, like, it's not illegal, number one, and it's not, I don't think, to write a fake news article. But they were saying it's on the American, you know, the American consumer.
Yeah.
To be more discerning about where their news is coming from. And they have a point. they have a point. And if people, you know, would do just a little bit of research to see where is this being posted, oh, it's being posted on some cockamamie website versus, you know, the New York Times or something. Because the New York Times doesn't do fake news. You know, you can, we were talking about like ideological bends in this net. But they don't do fake news at all. Yeah. None of them. I mean, no, even, I mean, BuzzFeed, we'll see what happens with this scandal, you know, not scandal, but this controversy that came out about the Mueller report, and they're saying about, you know, that the Trump basically instructed Michael Cohen to lie to Congress or something like that. But that could, I mean, we'll see if that's true or not. But in general, they're not writing fake news. There's just stories you might disagree with. So.
It's interesting that it seems like people, the general public, are kind of acting in this bizarre way if they both seek out like inflammatory and potentially more outrageous faker news, while at the same time then getting upset about fake news having taken place. I don't know. It's just, that's interesting for me to think about.
I think you probably
people
know
demanding
the answer.
Fake news, and at the same time,
it sounds like your department. That's a psychological thing, I think. But I did hear Barack Obama speak, a year ago, less than a year ago, something like that, where he's talking about in politics. Mm-hmm. It was helpful for him, as he'd say, you know, he'd interview all these people, he'd talk to all these people when he was running for, at the time he was talking about, it was like state Senate. No, I take it back. It was when he was running for Senate. And he had to travel all around Illinois, and people would tell him all this stuff, but then he listened to it, but then he saw what they, you know, spent their money on and what they spent their time on.
Yeah.
And that's what people care about, not what they tell you they care about. And so, again, I feel like we're not necessarily like the expert in this, but I think that certainly we see reverberations of this in just technology in general. People say that they don't like Facebook and Google and that they're uncomfortable with what they're doing.
But they're still using it.
I mean, I realized it today. I opened my Gmail and I checked Twitter and this and that. And, you know, if only there was an alternative, only people were working on a product that gave people an option about their data. And then we could see. But,
Well, so I want to, oh, I love that bait, but I'm not going to take it. So what does this do to journalists' incentive structure? Like, what are they incentivized to write? Because we've mentioned a bunch of different elements. There's the element of you want to be the first person to cover it. You don't want to get scooped. So you kind of have to rush the story. And that, you know, makes it difficult to get all your facts straight and to do all this extra double checking. Then there's sort of this element at the same time that people seem to like slant and outrage. And that's another factor to keep in mind. Mm-hmm. Then you've got concern about layoffs. And I don't know even... We haven't even talked about like what sort of decision-making structure is used in determining these layoffs. So what is it from your perspective as a journalist that drives you to write a specific story and like timelines and everything on those stories? So
sure,
broad
sure.
question.
Sure. No. So I think that first of all, there's, and we touched on it a little bit in the last conversation. You know, there's different, not kinds of journalists, but different journalists with different sort of focuses and what they're reporting of things. You have like breaking news journalists, you have enterprise journalists, which are like, you know, finding stories and sort of mm-hmm. reporting them out a little bit more, features, things like that. You have commentators who are sometimes called journalists or op-ed writers. And and so everyone kind of is incentivized differently, or at least their focus and goal is different. Obviously commentators, like their thing, it's the same thing as like Twitter, right? You just want to like have your opinion, have it be strong, have it touch a chord, so to speak, and be interesting and that's for them. And then breaking news is, you know, get the facts as quickly as you can and get them before everybody else and figure out what the hell happened and whatever the situation was. Mm-hmm. And then enterprise, you know, it's finding the hidden sort of things that are out there and reporting it out in a responsible way that is informative to people. But I think that at its root, all journalists are trying to inform the public. I think that's like the main point of it, and to do so, I mean, I would say in an accurate way, but again, you get on, you know, the edges here, and even in the middle, I think accurate is a tough word, but I think that it's applicable because what accurate means to different people, I think, probably, like I don't know many journalists, like professional journalists, colleagues of mine that like are like, no, I'm going to mislead the public to believe what I believe. Like, it's not really a thing. Like, and there's better ways to do it. It's hard. People think it's easy. It's hard. It's not hard to even get, like, a non-controversial article, like, through editors, and there's a process. It's not just, like, I write an article and post it on the Washington Post website. It's like, I write the article, I send it to my editor, he reviews it, sends it back, I send it back to him, he sends it back, I send it back to him. You know what I mean? It's a process there. And then, you know, depending on how big the story is, and someone else will take a look at it. It's usually the case. Someone else will take a look at it. A copy editor will take a look at it. So it's not easy. It's not easy to, like, you know, push an agenda. Of course, as you get older, as you become more senior as a journalist, you get more sort of, like, leeway, more trust. So then that's how you get, like, a Jason Blair situation. And he wasn't even that old, but, like, you know, he just got trust. Mm-hmm. And this guy in Germany, the same thing. So, I mean, it does happen. Obviously, it happens. I mean, but those are really big mistakes, and they're really problematic for the news outlets, and they usually are very, very good about stopping them, you know? Yeah. And I would put that in contrast to, like, you know, the Jason Blair and this German guy to, like, corrections and stuff. I mean, corrections are just, like, you have a factual error here and there, and usually it doesn't add up to, like, negligence, right? I mean, it happened. There was a New York Times article about, like, going back to the Israel thing real quick, where it was like, this guy wrote that, like, the connection of Jews to the Temple Mount is debatable or something. And it's not. That's not something that's debated seriously by anybody. And so, but, it's more the exception than the rule. So, getting back to the question, as far as incentives, so there's that. As, you know, look, the other thing is this, like, you're trying to write the story in a compelling way, too. Not to, like, make things up that aren't there, but, like, to write it so that people actually read it. I mean, what good is the article going to be if it's written just, like, in a dreary, tough, you know, whatever sort of thing? And of course, I'm talking more like features, right? When you're doing a breaking news story, when you're doing just, like, bam, 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 here's what happened, you know, like an AP sort of, like, wire thing, you don't care as much about that. You're just getting the information, you know, bam, 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 point, and get out. When you're talking about features and stuff, yeah, you're trying to make it, you know, so that somebody wants to read it, you know, so that you put the interesting stuff up top, hook them, and then keep it going. But, you know, obviously not in a way that, like, there's a way to do that with the information you have without people, you know, saying, making things up or making things juicier than they are. And usually when you try to do that, I think most of my colleagues would attest to this, like, the editors call it out. Like, when you read thousands of stories, like, you start, as an editor, you start figuring out, like, all right, like, that's, like, probably a little bit of embellishment. That's a little bit of this. And so...
So what kind of areas, what... I mean, I'm assuming it is the features that people get the most upset about with respect to fake news, with breaking news, like Covington Catholic. I mean, part of that was a breaking news problem, right?
Right. I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure. I think that with some of the times with the breaking news stories, there are people who get upset because people jump to certain narratives and certain conclusions. They use certain existing paradigms and then employ that in the narrative that they will see an event in. You see this all the time with shootings, unfortunately, where people are like, you know, guns rights issue, and no, it's not a guns rights issue, it's a mental health issue. No, it's a this. And so then sometimes that'll work its way into, like, including a paragraph about the gun and that background and that situation, or then including a paragraph about mental health and that situation. But a lot of times it's not mutually exclusive. Like, it could be both things, or you could include both paragraphs. So I don't know. I think that I haven't thought about that, if there's more on breaking news versus features in terms of, like, frustration or anger about
the fake news and everything.
Yeah. I guess it would be features, yeah. I mean, if we're talking about, like, the classic fake news, right? They're talking about, like, Hillary Clinton has a, what was it? It was, like, a child ring or something.
Yeah, prostitution ring.
Yeah, so, like, and that would be more in the future, so yeah.
Well, we have to wrap up this time in short and sweet, but give me hope for the future? Like, are you hopeful about the outlook of journalism in general, even though there are some challenges along the way, or is it all just bleak?
No, I'm glad you asked that question, because I don't want to misrepresent my sort of, you know, the grand conclusion of the whole thing, is that people want news. People need news. There will never not be a need for news in a democratic society. And so I think that, you know, hopefully it'll just make us as journalists better and cause us to raise our game, our skill level, whatever it is. So that's the good news.
Good. I'm so glad to hear that. Well, thank you so much for joining me again, Noah.
Thank you. Thank you.